Welcome all to this class on the Bodhisattva precepts. So we're looking at our 10 major precepts from the Brahmajala Sutra. This is the source of our 10 precepts, this Mahayana Sutra. And we're just going through each of the precepts one at a time. So we covered a kind of like sort of history of this evolution of Bodhisattva precepts, how it started from the Buddha's time. There were always precepts, and then this Mahayana Bodhisattva precept spirit came along with this Brahmajala Sutra, and then Zen precepts that Bodhidharma's one mind precepts that emphasize the ultimate nature of the precepts. And we talked about the not killing precept, the first one. So I thought tonight we can just keep going through them. Let's try to get through the second and the third precept tonight. And we can try to cover two a night. So, to jump right in, the second precept on page 2 of the sutra. This is the sutra version. That's the source of our Zen precepts. No stealing. And, we usually say in our precept ceremonies, not taking what's not given. But, this translation of the sutra here is like, looking at the Chinese. The sutra apparently emerged in China. So it's the maybe most, accurate translation of the Chinese. Really just says no stealing. But the Pali canon, the early version, actually has this word, adinadana, that I think literally means taking what's not given, not dana. So I think our wording, not taking what's not given, is a very nice wording, I think. And I think we looked at different versions of these, and ours comes not from the Chinese Brahmajala Sutra, but from the Pali canon, not taking what's not given. But meaning is the same, it's not stealing or theft. Maybe not taking what's not given has an even stronger feeling, right? It's like really, having this very receptive feeling. We just receive what comes to us. So the description of the precept from the sutra says, a disciple of Buddha does not steal, encourage others to steal by expedient means, or steal by means of deviant mantras. So a few of them have the same language. They're like everything is kind of like bringing together the conditions of of theft. One should not create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of stealing. No valuables or possessions, even those belonging to ghosts and spirits, or thieves and robbers, be they as small as a needle or a blade of grass, may be stolen. So paying attention to, not just major car theft or something, but a needle or a blade of grass. A bodhisattva ought to have a mind of kindness, compassion, and devotion, always helping people generate merit and happiness. If instead one steals the possessions of others, one commits a parajika offense, or a major bodhisattva violation of this precept. So that's the kind of literal meaning of the precept in the sutra. As I mentioned earlier, sometimes this Brahmajala Sutra is, the whole comments are read out in ordination ceremonies, and so Soto Zen and in general, maybe all the Japanese Mahayana Buddhist schools, their precepts are based on this sutra. So in Zen, we often talk about the literal meaning of the precepts, which is like this straightforward presentation, the compassionate meaning of the precepts, and the ultimate meaning. So I think it's nice to talk about each of those three briefly before we go into like all kinds of examples in our own lives of taking what's not given and how we work with it. So the compassionate level or way to relate to the precepts is brought up beautifully in Asanga's bodhisattva stages, and we studied this a couple years ago. But he has a nice, on each of these 10 wholesome or unwholesome actions, he has a nice example of a compassionate way to practice with this that goes against the literal meaning. So the literal is like literally not stealing, right? The compassionate level is these, sometimes there's these unusual cases where it's more appropriate to break the literal meaning. And each of the precepts has these examples. So Asanga, in this case, he brings up two examples. One is like, I'm thinking of, you know, it's election time, and he's talking about overthrowing a tyrannical dictator that's causing a lot of harm in some country. Right? So you're not really given the power of to be the next ruler of the country. But you, it's like a coup, right? You overthrow the corrupt government as a bodhisattva activity to benefit the beings in this country. Does that make sense? So you're actually taking what's not given, but that's your bodhisattva vow to do that. In some, you know, these are kind of fanciful situations, but we might imagine if there's no other alternative to just, you know, do something democratically, you might do this overthrow. And the other example that Asanga brings up is when people steal possessions from the Sangha in particular. And a lot of the commentaries on stealing say this is the worst kind of stealing from the three treasures. So I think, how do you steal from a Buddha? Maybe it would be like if there's a Buddha shrine with valuable offerings, or, you know, gold Buddha or something, and you steal that. It's kind of like stealing from the Buddha. And stealing from the Sangha would be like, I think actually practical ways that it does play out, especially in residential communities. And for me here, for example, I try to be conscious of this kind of thing. Like we have a Xerox machine, right? This Sangha has a Xerox machine. And sometimes I have like personal copies to make. And it's very easy to, I'm kind of used to making Zen Center copies. And it's easy to, well, I just need to make this one copy, so I'll just go use the machine in the office here. And, but if, you know, I usually, if I do that for a personal thing, I'll try to remember to actually like put a donation in the donation box. Maybe even more than 10 cents, because I'm not even asking. It seems like too much trouble, maybe. Maybe it would be good to ask the treasurer or the president, may I make a copy and put a donation in the box? But I feel like they'd probably say yes. But I think it's nice to make, to, you know, maybe 50 cents or a dollar, because it's like using the community resources. So, and without doing that, it would be a little bit like a needle, right? Not very much, not very valuable, but a little bit of like taking something from the Sangha, which they say is much worse than taking it from like your company's Xerox machine. And why is that? Maybe because we honor the sacred Sangha so much that like we want to like take care of that most. So Asanga's example is, if some robbers take some things, especially from the Sangha or from like a shrine, that the Bodhisattva can go and take them back and give them back to the shrine. And he says, in particular, to help them from their unwholesome karma of stealing from the three treasures. You kind of like, even though they did the act, maybe by bringing it back, you're like, it lessens their karma, even if they don't know that it went back to the shrine. And or to think of other examples in our culture, like Robin Hood, right, is maybe a classic archetype in our Western culture of, I don't remember the story of Robin Hood exactly, but it's this thing of, you know, stealing from the rich, and maybe in Robin Hood's story, like the kind of the corrupt and greedy rich, to give to the poor when they wouldn't do it themselves. So Robin Hood's kind of a hero, right? He's a thief, but he's like a kind of bodhisattva hero for us. And I think that's very similar to this compassionate meaning of not stealing.
I think in Robert and the poor, that wasn't their money. That wasn't their money before.
No, in that case, it wasn't theirs before. But he maybe still felt like it was this inequity in his town. Yeah, and let's just, this would be helpful. It's, you know, I think there's all kinds of gray area in reality if we were to do this kind of thing. Yeah.
The area where I've had sort of struggled to try and work out my relationship is when I see food growing on trees and it's going to waste. And so I make an effort to go and knock on the door and say, are you going to use this thing? But if I can't get through to anyone and the food just keeps on going to waste, I end up, I usually do just pick it. But then what I try to do is say, okay, to try not cultivate greed in myself, I'll try and be generous with that food that I picked and give it to other people. And that's how I dealt with all the food that the kids grow across the road, and then they're all gone for the summer and it all just sits there. Yeah. So I would pick it and put it out for other people to take, and then later in the day if it was still there, then I'd take it home. And that's how I dealt with it. So that feels like that thing around sort of a compassionate, not literal.
Yeah.
Because I have this sense that there's starving people everywhere and just and seeing food go to waste and people taking no, paying no attention to it just doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't feel good about that. So I just want to utilize it somehow.
Yeah.
So that, that's how I've kind of tried to manage that.
Yeah. And I think the compassionate level of the precept, especially when it goes against, usually the compassionate level and the literal level line up quite nicely. But these, it's nice to have these examples where they, occasionally where they might not. And I think the compassionate is pointing to the fact that it's always about benefiting beings. So sometimes we could be like so caught up in the word or the literal meaning of the precept that it's like we forget that this is all about benefiting beings. And so I think it's a nice Mahayana reminder. And so that's a nice example also of, we could say not benefiting, or, you know, it's about benefiting beings and not harming beings. So around stealing, also there's a lot of areas where it might be like, and we can talk about some of these, where it might not actually be harming anyone, even though it is kind of a stealing or taking what's not given. And I think these are questionable things. I think the main thing is we're not, if it's obviously harming others or ourselves, and it's taking what's not given, and it's generally, we don't. So that's the compassionate view of the precepts. And then the ultimate view of the precepts is more where the Zen tradition comes in. And each of them has their own version. And so this is Dogen. And Dogen's Kyoju Kaimon, his commentary on the precepts. For this second one, he says, in the suchness of mind and objects, the gate of liberation is open. So the suchness is like the true ungraspable reality of mind and objects. In this true, we could say non-duality of mind and objects, the gate of liberation is open. Maybe kind of a cryptic comment on not stealing, right? But isn't that what stealing is about? Is we feel like there's objects outside us that we want for us. It's based on the view of duality. And all of these ultimate precepts are pointing towards our false belief in this dualistic separation and, dissolving that illusion so that we don't actually try to take what's not given. And then Dogen's disciple Kyogo, he has an essay on essence of Brahma's net. So his commentary on this Brahma Net Sutra is a Soto Zen teaching. And he says, if you want to steal objects, how could you, since there is not a speck of dust outside of mind? So I think that's the same thing in a way his commentary on Dogen. There isn't a speck of dust outside the mind. So if you want to steal something outside the mind, how could you really do that? So that's the kind of ultimate meaning of the precepts. And then, yes?
Where does the ultimate fit in with trying to live, work the ethical
I think the beauty of these three levels, these three views, the literal, the compassionate, and the ultimate, the beauty of them is that in general, though there might be some exceptions we can bring up, in general they all go together perfectly. And the way that they do is by, I think Zen generally points at, we start with the ultimate. Traditional Zen is more like just realize non-duality and then your life will take care of itself. And I think the way we could see this, like in this case, would be if you really truly realize, not kind of get the intellectual idea of it or some, you know, some concept of this, but actually really understand that nothing is truly outside of you, then you follow the literal very nicely. You actually don't, because you don't have a reason to steal. So I think the problem is, if you get the ultimate, but you don't really realize that, but you just use the idea, well, there's nothing really outside, so then I might as well just take it. Then we're like, well, why are you taking it if it's really not outside? So I think if really truly realizing non-duality, we become harmless, beneficial beings, like inevitably, like without exception, I would even say, if we really realize. And I think that's the Zen take on these. So it's not meant to be like a kind of clever way to avoid following literally. It's the opposite. It's more like, this will really take care of the literal. Like we talked last week about the killing precept. If we really realize that there is no duality between life and death and nothing is born and dies truly, like really deeply realize that, then we cannot kill literally, because killing, the literal violation of these precepts is always for a separate self. I think always, or virtually always, is some, I want to either eliminate something, because it's bothering me, like killing a mosquito, or, I want to get something for me, like killing something for me to eat or whatever. It's always based on a separation, I think. So, and it's beautiful that each of these ultimate precepts of non-duality has its own slightly different version, right? So killing's about life and death and whether they truly can be found, and stealing is more about mind and objects, or also I think of ownership, like basically the illusion of ownership, if we can really see that nobody really owns things. It's a conventional agreement. And I don't either. So therefore, if I feel like I want to own this, so I'm going to take it from you, I'm like, I'm already basing this on delusion. Yes, so in the suchness of mind and objects, the gate of liberation is open. Very nice. And then Kyogo, if you want to steal objects, how could you, since there's not a speck of dust outside of mind? And then Banjin Dotan is some generations later, our Soto Zen ancestor, has an essay on the essence of Zen precepts that Tenzin Roshi loosely based his book on. And his comment on this is, what treasure does one want to steal? The whole universe in 10 directions is one bright jewel. Or one bright pearl. And that's a quote from the Zen ancestors. And I think he's playing with this idea of a bright jewel or bright pearl is this valuable thing that we might want to steal. So what kind of treasure or jewel does one want to steal? The whole universe in 10 directions is one bright treasure or jewel. It's a kind of poetic way of talking about this non-duality. And then he goes on to say, the radiance of the bright jewel is the precept light of not stealing. This is beautiful. And this is referring to this, we talked about the earlier part of the sutra where the Buddha says the precept light comes forth from the Buddha's mouth, and this light is not blue or red or yellow, and it's not born and doesn't die. This precept light is like the suchness of the precepts. So the radiance of the one bright jewel is the precept light of not stealing. I just think it's a very Zen way of of talking kind of poetically from this ultimate perspective. So then we have the actual nitty-gritty issues, right? So some examples that I think of are taxes. So, like, you know, we might feel like, where do the tax laws, you know, encourage us actually, right, to take our exemptions and so on. But there's all kinds of gray area, right, where we can, how much do we fudge claiming things and to get a better sort of deal and not report certain things. I think for many people feel like, well, you know, it's like you can do it this way or that way, and how about just do it this way? But I think it's a nice reflection on this precept, is taking what's not given. And I think one way I've sometimes thought of that, if I'm going in that sort of fudging area, is like, well, is it really harming anyone? This is like Uncle Sam, right? He's a wealthy guy. He doesn't care about my extra $100 or something. So, or other ways that we maybe take, not from an individual person, where it maybe either hurts them or violates our relationship with them, if personally, but institutions in general, I think is harder to feel that we're taking something. And especially on taxes, we might feel like, I don't even like where my taxes are going to be spent. But in fact, over time, I've an example for me is dana, like, you know, donations. There's some years where I've gotten donations as a Dharma teacher, and I contacted this list of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, like, I actually don't know the tax laws about this. Do you have to claim this dana? And some said, no, you definitely don't. This is Dharma. This is a Dharma offering. You keep Dharma and taxes separate. And other people said, no, you're wrong. There were some lawyers. There's some Zen lawyers, right? Yeah. Zen priest lawyers. Yes, yes. And they kind of like, wait a second, where'd you get that from? So it's interesting. Yeah. And, so it was, now my current understanding is that there's still some gray area, I think, when we started talking about it, but because gifts, like gifts from your parents, for example, you don't claim, right? That's different.
Up to $10,000.
Yes, yeah, I think like that. So I don't have to worry about $10,000.
What about the scarf you got for Christmas? You don't
know. Yeah. But even $1,000, I guess, right, from your parents or family.
Anything up to $10,000.
And I think that that some of these Zen teachers, what they said, is it is a gift, and I think we try to understand dana in Buddhism as truly a gift with no strings attached. It's not a payment for services. So this is part of the gray area. And yet, I think some people ended up still saying that it's because of your role as a Zen teacher that they're giving it. Even though it's not for services, sometimes it might be, you know, not because you did a wedding ceremony but just because you're in that role. And this is a traditional Buddhist thing, right? You support the monks not for anything particular, but just that they're doing that practice. So it's almost like a parent. And you might even have like a friend who's also in the Sangha, right? That gives you, they have a personal connection to you, but they also know that you're doing this practice, and maybe you have low income because you're practicing full-time or something. So some people said if it's connected with that particular role, then it's still kind of like taxable. I think some of the priest lawyers said. So I've been trying to sort of claim that, which I didn't in the past. It just kind of it feels more wholehearted to try to keep, you know, thinking about this precept.
Someone made a good suggestion when taxes as a sort of political statement, war and not saying if you really genuinely don't want to pay your taxes for that reason, to make sure that you're doing it for that reason, but also for something convenient, then donate that equipment.
There you go.
So
yeah, yeah.
Strategy, even with if you don't want to pay taxes on that donor, and argue that it's not taxable, to be really clear in your mind, you can say, so I'll give 20% of any donor that I receive to the homeless shelter or something.
Yeah.
I think that would be a fair solution.
And I think if we truly passed it all along to others, then I think it really wouldn't be any question. It's not taxable. It's just letting it pass through.
Which is the ultimate understanding.
Something like that. Yes.
But even, you know, on occasion I will fill up a black garbage bag with my clothes that I don't wear anymore, and I take it to the good drop-off station. And they'll very nicely say, so how much is this worth? To give to me. This donation. I have no idea. The solution is, I don't have to claim anything. I can't say anything to the fellow who, needs it form. I don't have to, what is that shirt that I bought in the 80s?
$50.
Autograph.
There's many ways that we can think about who's gaining here. Who's not gaining?
Right. It is a lot about the mind of gain and loss. Go ahead.
I have a friend who I've done it once, but kind of love of the earth and not wanting to play the fossil fuel game at all to get from point A to B. He technically steals rides from Union Pacific.
Rides. Train hopping. Freight hopping.
The purpose of the train is just to move products for sale back and forth, and it's like, technically, if you get caught, they tell you, well, you're stealing this ride.
Yeah.
You have to pay for things. And like,
That's a little bit like a Robin Hood example in some ways, especially, again, if you're doing it to save the money is a little different than if you're doing it to save fossil fuels, then it's, I think, an intention with all the precepts, even in the early Vinaya precepts, it's always about intention. So there's ways that you can break precepts unintentionally, like you step on an ant without knowing it. It's not really killing because it's not intentional. So in this case, it's interesting. And also, I think a key thing is, what's the intention? Is it about personal gain, kind of even at the expense of others? And maybe most importantly, is it actually harming others? So the freight hopping thing, I could really see it as, it really is not causing any harm. Unless you got in an accident. If you're careless with yourself and you got run over by the train and then the train company gets sued or something, then that's different. But taxes, you might say, it's such a minimal harm, but maybe in a way you're like taking that money away from the road repair or whatever all the taxes go to help us. The war tax resisting thing, I think, is also valid. Or another way it might be is, like, I've heard people say that if you do it, but you are honest about it, because remember, we bring in all the other precepts apply. So are you doing something which you wouldn't want to let on that you're doing? And then that's an interesting piece too. But if you're like, I am intentionally not paying the tax, and I'm going to write you a letter here that I'm resisting arms, military spending or something, then it's like, it turns it a little bit because there's honesty. Yes.
I have a bit of stickiness with the Robin Hood example because things like that are... My question is, where do we stand as the kind of crux of how to follow the precepts? Because I could be Robin Hood to myself, and that's not exactly right in a lot of cases, but what we're deciding is how we follow the precepts. So I don't want to lean towards the literal meaning, because I don't think that the literal meaning covers reality. But I also don't trust myself as Robin Hood.
Well, I think in the archetype of Robin Hood's story, as I recall it, he really was this feeling like he wasn't in it for himself at all, right? I think it really was a bodhisattva thing. He didn't keep any for himself, right? He's just passing it on to those who need it. And we might say, is there a self-righteous, you know, sentiment behind it? In which case it might be a little off. But if he doesn't even want any credit for it, and it's no, with no anger, maybe either, like, I'm just redistributing wealth. I don't know. It's dangerous, right? So
that's... Yeah, I don't know if I want too many Robin Hoods.
No,
maybe
not too many.
For the sake of the story, this one.
Yeah, yeah. So in general, I think when we have the literal, the compassionate, and the ultimate, again, I would say, like in almost all cases, I think they would all be identical. The way that it looks in the world will be identical. It's just that when you break them into these three, particularly the compassionate, is we're trying to come up with these exceptions that would be rare exceptions, I think, usually. Well, Ken had something?
I was just saying that if you broke it up, if you gave it all away, that still wouldn't be right.
Still wouldn't be right.
Still wouldn't be right.
Yeah.
That's still illegal. It's still wrong. It's taking other people's money. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I don't know what Robin Hood... say.
Yeah.
Not right because, yeah, I think in general not right.
You
like,
have to give all the money away.
I don't know. I don't remember the Robin Hood story, but maybe to make the story nice, it was, we can imagine that Robin Hood's stealing from these very corrupt and like way overly wealthy, like people who have like 17 ocean liners, you know, and like.
I'm starting to hear denial. I feel like it's sticky too. Like some of these examples are a little bit kind of too idealistic.
They maybe are idealistic, but maybe they are bringing out the point that there could be cases where it would be appropriate. I think that's maybe not. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I think what kind of what comes in is. Agreements and standards, and the part of the ultimate truth is that we are all interconnected. So I think one check always for myself on whether or not something is slippery is am I hiding it?
Yes, the honesty
and
part.
So
yep.
I think the safety in agreements is there's the possibility that you know, and then agreements extend out in layers and layers and layers, you know, but there's the possibility that that there could be taking care of everyone and everything, you know, but the limitation when we make that decision is we in one solo consciousness boxed up as we are, we don't really have all the information, of who's hurt and who's not hurt.
So that's another good point about the precepts in general is if we're just one piece is the honesty part, which I think will apply to each one as we talk about them, and the other is like if we're just completely deciding on our own and we really don't want any other input, is that's maybe somewhat questionable too, right? But if we're kind of like, if Robin Hood checks with like a bunch of his friends and says like, what do you think about that? I'm thinking of doing, you know, you could say, well, he should choose a assortment of different kinds of friends. But I think in general, that's right. It's like it's more relational. There's more people involved, makes them, a more informed, balanced decision. Yes.
The Asanga example that you gave last time, too, about the boat.
Yeah.
Arranged boat captain.
Yeah.
It's pretty much identical to what's used now for ethical and in terms of utilitarian, the most good for the most people.
Yeah.
The classic example of, if a train is speeding down, it's about to kill five people. You could switch it and it would only kill one.
Right.
You do that.
Yeah.
An example.
Yep.
So that,
and maybe even real life example would be like, Saddam Hussein or somebody, we're gonna go in and the U.S. is gonna try to pinpoint this person and kill them to prevent other harm. So I think there are, real life examples of trying, for the benefit of beings, to kill someone, occasionally. And then there's all kinds of questions in real life examples because it's so complicated, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, you said you don't trust yourself as Robin Hood, but like on the ultimate level, it's like we learn to trust ourselves. Like, what does it feel like to be free? How do I breathe when I'm not trying to gain anything for myself? Mm-hmm. How do I breathe when I'm not clinging to anything?
Nice. Yeah.
Kind of like a gauge.
Yeah.
Like you go to do the Xerox, it's easier with something like the Xerox machine, right? They're like, oh, I'll just make a copy for myself, but like something that's not intellectual.
Yep, yeah.
It's just like some felt, bodily sense that we like try to attune with. It's like if you sit Zazen long enough, you probably will be able to trust yourself as Robin Hood. Okay. Oh, right? Like, that's what we're doing.
And I think these 10 bodhisattva precepts are nice because they're not cultural things. There's lots of other, Indian precepts that are based on certain societies and cultural values. The nice thing about these 10 is they're completely universal. There are other ways that, that humans, hurt each other out of belief in duality. So I think we do have that slight feeling of uneasiness, if we can trust that it's because they're, another term that's sometimes used for bodhisattva precepts is natural precepts, means that they're true in every society, in every case, because they're just about being a sentient being. And, so we can trust something. And I think we might feel guilty about something culturally that maybe isn't really true. We can get over that feeling of uneasiness of like, actually, I think this really is okay, but even though society doesn't agree, maybe something like gay marriage is something that's changing in our culture that people felt was unethical at some point, and now we're being like, as a natural precept, there's nothing unethical about this, but I think the natural precepts we do have that natural feeling when we're quiet and still. Yeah.
It's like natural, like your body wants to relax and like having a sashimi, you could be super uptight. I know I am. But like eventually it moves towards relaxing. It like wants to let go.
Yeah.
That's
another way to think of bodhisattva precepts is like, is there some holding on to anything? Yeah, or do we feel the ease of not non-grasping, and maybe we can go through the day actually somewhat in the ease of non-grasping, and then we come into these situations where it gets tighter, and they're often around these precepts. I think, interestingly, maybe other situations too, but often. So I think another one in modern times about taking what's not given is the whole issue of digital copyright. I mean, it's really interesting that you're not actually, there's nothing physical to take anymore, right? We're talking about these bytes and stuff, these non-tangible things, but it does have financial implications, right?
Intellectual property, they work on it.
So you could say what you're, if you're... I think it is.
I imagine if you're an artist, a musician, and you really put your heart and soul and time into, or an author, you create something. The way it's been in the world, so, unless you just completely give it away, it is yours.
And you're losing your income if people take it. And I think particularly if people take it and then resell it, which definitely happens in this world, right? And then somebody else is making a profit off your thing without doing anything. I think you could say one might consider these gray areas where you're like, I would not buy this music, for example. I'm not that interested enough. But then it comes to me, you know, for free. I'm like these days, all this stuff is on YouTube, right? And so there it is. And so it's not exactly that I am taking the money away from this musician because I would not have bought it. But it's here, and I'll listen to it for free, you know. That's, in a way, it's gray. You could say, I'm still getting something for myself. Wouldn't it be nice to support them? But this question of, is someone being harmed that they wouldn't have been otherwise, you know, depends how strictly we see these things. But it's definitely a modern issue that's big time. I mean, they say at the end of the movies, right, like the years in prison for, like, copying this movie. It used to be record albums, right? But growing up, everyone I knew made tapes of each other's record albums. I think it's technically was illegal. Do you know that?
Yeah, we just were innocent of
that. Yeah, and people didn't think about it, trading stuff, right? But never, if they were selling it, it would have a different feeling. Yeah.
Well, I'll confess. I'm listening to Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac almost every day, and sometimes there'll be, you know, like this perfect poem that he'll say at the end that, you know, I'll say, oh, I'll use that in the Dharma talk. So you can go to the website, and everything he says that day is on the Writer's Almanac website, including that last poem. It's all like written out. Mm. And so I could just copy it by hand, I suppose, and read it from my handwriting. But actually, you can just do the screen print maneuver on your computer and print it out.
But then do you credit the person who wrote it?
But still, it's not exactly like I bought the Mary Oliver book that it came out of.
We're quoting the line. Yeah, that seems like...
But you know what, Patrick? You're playing too hard on yourself here. I'm sure Garrison Keillor is upright in his copyright...
Send NPR $5.
I think that's a big one.
We're talking about needles here. I just want to that I have stolen needles.
It's good to consider all of these things. I mean, I can make a much bigger confession of, like, I have literally thousands of PDF Dharma books in, like, an entire library that's all just come to me from friends sending me this stuff who collected, and some of it's people have scanned in. I mean, it's all over the internet, right? People have spent hours scanning books so that you can download, but some of them are, like, the professional versions of them. And it's floating around, and I think I've seen a lot of Dharma people say, well, the Dharma should be freely available, because in the old days, in fact, I think nobody was making money off it. Nowadays, people do. So I think that's somewhat questionable. If I was ever trying to make money off of that myself, that would be way questionable. And I feel like if I write a book, which I hope to do sometime, and probably would probably sell it in the usual way, and if I found out that somebody found, you know, scanned it or was doing the PDF, I don't think I personally would have a problem at all. I think enough people want to buy the book anyway, you know. But other people might be like, that takes away some sales. So that's a confession. That's more than a needle, probably. But it's a funny thing, the digital world.
I think it's one thing to have, but it's another thing to sell.
Yes, big difference of selling. Yep. And I have and movies, digital movies, I have quite a few that have just been given to me, and again, I would never sell them, but sometimes, again, people do this trading thing, and sometimes they feel like, even to give it to somebody else, would they have bought it otherwise? That's the kind of question that comes to me. Like, a lot of these movies, I would never have bought them, and if I just got rid of them, I could easily do without them. I'd say, well, why don't you do it? But I haven't. Yeah, I have. I have, yeah.
There's a little bit of a twitch in your body.
Yeah. So Dharma movies. But yeah, I think that's right. If you're using it to benefit beings, hopefully.
Kathy's going to absolve you once you...
No, I'm not. I'm going the other direction. I am interested in why we put more attention on thinking about the exceptions to, like, get ourselves off the hook. I think that a lot of this is we're fascinated by... How can we, what's the straight up like, I'm not making self-other, because I have my own areas where I do things that others might say, oh my God, really, you do that? So, but it's curious to me, is there such a thing as just kind of a pure, like, no, I'm not going to do that because that's stealing.
Well, I think that's the literal. Well, I think the could be. I think it's worth looking. Like, I'm someone myself who was really into the Buddha's, like, Vinaya precepts, which is very literal, you know. So there were years of practice where I don't even know why there is this precept, and I don't care. I'm just going to follow it exactly. And I feel like from a deeper, more Mahayana practice mind, I think I was kind of like on a trip about that. I'm like, I'm just going to be the goodest boy around and follow it. So literal. And I think, like, what's the point? I don't think that was the point of the Buddha's precepts, right? So I think we have to keep looking. What's the point? What's the point of not stealing? And I think if there's a greed or a kind of clinging in these kind of cases, maybe there is. And then that's what's to look at. But more than, like, is it literally stealing or not? What's this precept pointing to? Is it showing me a kind of greediness? And then I think that's maybe the point. Or showing a kind of delusion of separation or something. Yeah.
I really liked what Liz said about linking it to honesty.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's what I use as a gauge for myself. So, like, with the tomatoes across the road, when I saw the gardener when school started back, I straight away went up and told her. And I said, I'd be taking the tomatoes or somewhere, and also the beans, and just let her know. And then I felt like, okay, so I think I'm all right with this. I think I'm doing okay.
And see what her response is, too.
Yeah,
right?
She's like, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And then there was, I think, 3 weeks before school started where I had to actually restrain myself then. Then I'd gotten used to picking them. Mm-hmm. And it was like, now I shouldn't pick them because the kids are going to come back. Well, I did say I was going to give him a card, and then I never got around to it. But anyhow, that I think is a really good gauge. You know, I'm going to do something that feels like there's a logic to not be literal. Then I also have to be comfortable to be like, yeah, open.
very open. If I'm still kind of like, then maybe I'm making excuses.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a really helpful way.
Kind of a needle that's been coming up for me lately is working in other people's gardens and realizing I would just love to have my own relationship with the garden. So putting in more plants than maybe the person wants to take care of. You know, like realizing laying in bed at night, like, oh, they kind of just, they're afraid of their garden. They want a simple relationship with it. They want it to just work. And maybe I put too many things in there that is going to me, it was really beautiful and fun, but they may not want to look at them and wonder if they're doing okay. So it comes down to the communication and valuing that other person's emotions and choices and path, and just having some restraint on my own.
Even though it looks very generous, you could see how it's this taking what's not given in this other kind of way, even though they might actually see it as very generous too.
The voicemail, oh, the plants will grow nice. Yeah. I didn't get that until this morning.
And lastly, to move on to the next precept, but I just thought another interesting one I thought of is taking from, not just from humans, but taking what's not given from animals, right? So like wool, eggs, milk, honey, right? It's like, is it really given? And again, we could say, yeah, but that's how the natural world works. They're just giving it for us. Yes, thank you. I thought of that too. It's taking from the earth. Exactly. Taking what's not given from the earth, yeah, in so many ways. Petroleum's the obvious one, but,
yeah. Chickens don't give up those eggs either. You have to knock them off their nest.
Yes.
I think of that when I think of drug sniffing dogs and stuff, like, we haven't asked the dog.
Even like a workhorse or something, is it taking the time and energy of that animal without it being given? So it's, you know, I think it's great because we can think of these pieces, not killing, not stealing. I don't do that stuff. That's easy. But I think with each of these precepts, as we unpack it, the intricacies are, it's very humbling. Yeah. And great, I think it's great meditation. I think we can also start feeling super guilty if we start talking about precepts like this and like, I'm a horrible, practitioner of precepts. But I think more like a meditation practice, can we be forgiving and just use it as pointers to being upright, and kind of like what Emily was saying, is can these all be ways to help us feel like totally relaxed about non-separation? Many different angles in on this. Yes, and then let's go on.
My aunt is a Catholic nun, everything that she's wearing, she doesn't wear a habit, but everything that she's wearing, she got from somebody. But and she appreciates clothes, but it's really clear that she really doesn't have any covetous energy. So I'm like, oh, thanks for that, Aunt Rose. And she's like, hey, you got that from Mary Ann, or Lisa gave that to me, or something. So her kind of relaxed appreciation and her real feeling of
receiver and gift.
Makes you want to give.
Like,
oh, I'd like to give her clothes.
Did you have a quick piece?
Just the ultimate one that talked about how the whole universe.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I really like that too because, I mean, if you feel that gratitude,
yeah,
I mean, you have everything.
Yeah. Yeah. You have. Yes.
Why would you need it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just steal anything. Yep. Anyway.
Another way to say it would be everything is yours already, mm-hmm. from this ultimate point of view. Everything is ours. And I think it's true. And when we don't feel that reality, we get something else. Yeah. So that was juicier than I thought. Now we got a really juicy one. No sexual greed. And again, this is like the literal Chinese characters. We often say misusing sexuality, and there are versions within Soto Zen where they actually, this one has slightly different variations. Some say like no sexual greed or even desire. Some say have a character that actually means misuse or inappropriate, which I think changed over time. But the sutra version, it's got this character, the Chinese character means sex, but there's other character. I tried to look into this some. Because if it says no sex, you could interpret it as like, that means celibacy. And some people do interpret it, but these are bodhisattva precepts for lay people too, and everybody. So looking into this character, it looks like it's more about like lewdness. When you, in the dictionary, it's like licentiousness, lewdness. Other ways that it's put are like lustfulness. Indecency, indulgence, or excessiveness. And then there's another character for sex that I think is the more positive version of, like, you know, sex as a good thing. And interestingly, this is just a little footnote, and I don't know enough about the Chinese to unpack this, but that character is the same one that we use to translate nature, as in the Buddha nature. Like Busho, that character Sho, Dharma nature and Buddha nature means also gender, but also sex in a more like positive, not a kind of lewd way.
Generative.
Generative, yeah, yeah, and maybe part. Yeah, and the etymology of the Chinese character is heart combined with life. That means nature and also means sex. Right? So there's these two different characters that often doesn't get brought out. And then sometimes they put in this kind of greed, one next to it. So no sexual greed is how Tenshin Roshi translates it in being upright, I think. And the sutra says, a disciple of Buddha does not indulge in sexual greed or encourage others to do so. One should not indulge in sexual greed with any human, animal, deity, or spirit, nor create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of such conduct. One must not engage in inappropriate sexual conduct with anyone. I think there they maybe put in the misusing character. A bodhisattva ought to have a mind of devotion, rescuing all sentient beings and instructing them in the dharma of purity. If instead one lacks compassion and encourages others to engage in sexual relations promiscuously, including with animals and even their parents, children, siblings, or close relative, one commits a parajika offense. And then I thought this was interesting in the Pali canon, early version of these 10 wholesome actions. Most of them are quite straightforward. The definitions of killing and stealing are pretty straightforward. But we might wonder, what is sexual misconduct or misusing sexuality in the early Indian time? And the sutra, this is the Salayaka Sutta of the Pali canon, where he's going through these 10 unwholesome actions. So this means, it's defined here as, and this is, you know, often they're worded about women, and the sutras are being written to men, but I think I tried to take the gender out of this translation, and but sometimes it sounds that way. But so this one says, having intercourse with such women, we could say, or men, as are protected, but I think this particularly fits with Indian cultural set up with women, women that are protected by their mother, father, brother, sister, relatives. So I think this is part of Indian culture, is they're still under, they're young enough that they're under the protection of their family. That's not appropriate. Or they have a husband, or somehow it entails some penalty, or it's illegal or something. And also those that are garlanded in token of betrothal, which I think just means they're engaged to be married. That's the definition of misusing sexuality. So it's not about what kind of sex you're having or anything. It's about, particularly in this case, the people are inappropriate people. That's all it is. And they're inappropriate because they have another commitment. Also, it says nuns with a commitment of celibacy is also one of them. So I think in all cases, they're committed to their parents, or they're committed to another person, or they're committed to the precept of celibacy. And then you're kind of encouraging them to break their commitments.
I mean, it sounds like when they're committed to their parents, it's because they're minors.
Yeah, they're minors. So they're temporarily committed to their parents. Exactly, they're minors. So I think that's a nice, straightforward way of talking in the early tradition. So that, and the literal meaning is kind of like this, right? The compassionate, again, hopefully the compassionate lines up, but the exception, and you know, I think it's just interesting that in the 4th century in India, Asanga tried to come up with a compassionate exception for each of these. And again, these are like, really? Sometimes. But his exception is like, there's somebody, in this case, he's talking about this, a male bodhisattva and a female who is like overcome by like sexual desire to the point where she's going crazy. And even at the point of like suicide. And, you know, really? Right. But, and then this bodhisattva, not for himself, but only out of great compassion, right? We'll go into this realm.
To save you.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So we can imagine like, wait a second, but maybe in a more, you know, and maybe this is a case where it's not even in one of these conditions. It doesn't say she's under the care of her parents or she's married or something like that. And it says if it's a monk with a vow of celibacy, he can never, even out of compassion, never go down that road, actually. So, but if all the other conditions, then it's more like just the actual relationship. Right? It's not like you're some like violation, then it's more like a consensual, beneficial thing. And we might even say, it's a nice way to look at relationships in general, is if we're getting together with somebody, or if we're in a sexual relationship, is it for oneself, which is our usual way of thinking, I think, at least to some extent, or is it really like for the other? And we might say that's too high a standard, but as a bodhisattva vow, can we turn it, especially when we're having trouble in the relationship, can we keep turning it back to like, I want to offer my life to this person, even if it's not going so well for me? Then I think that's what makes, I think, intimate relationships into truly bodhisattva practices. But I think our usual culture is, what am I getting out of it? How's it going for me? And if it's not going so well, we separate, right? So I think often people come to me with relationship questions, and I'd like to bring it back to that part. And I like, and for myself, I like to try to practice that way. And it's hard sometimes because we do have our own needs, right? And this stuff is so beyond rationality. All intimate relationships are totally irrational. They make no sense. But if we find ourselves in one, maybe even it's like, what am I doing in this? I think I made a mistake, or it was actually was just for my own, it was somewhat self-serving, and now it's not. This, I think, kind of thing happens often in the world. And then can we turn and like, well, whatever non-bodhisattva reasons I ended up in it, can I now make it a bodhisattva relationship? Can I give my life to this person you know, as is appropriate. If the person doesn't want me to, then maybe not. In fact, around relationships with my teacher, Tenshin Roshi, he would sometimes say, especially like as a priest or a senior practitioner, if you're going to be in relationship, then it's basically, or if you're thinking about breaking up, I think he even went so far to say it, like, you, no matter how bad it's going, you should never break up with the other person. Mm. Oh. I think it actually came to that kind of statement, and that let them make that move, and if they want to, you should go for it. So basically give them all the power and control as the senior practitioner. And I thought, in a way, it might sound weird and unbalanced.
Why?
I think because to make it into like a practice that to really emphasize that you're doing this just as a giving practice, you know, that you're not trying to make it the best situation for you. So it's kind of high standard. Maybe people can't actually do that completely, but it was a nice pointer, I thought. Yeah, and then, you know, if both people have this bodhisattva commitment, then both of them maybe are like, I'm just in it for you. And you might be like, well, I'm just in it for you. And, well, should we separate? Oh, I don't know. Maybe it doesn't matter anymore. And maybe that would be the most beautiful relationship. Doesn't matter if we're together or not, because we're just... And I've also heard maybe Joko Beck talks about, like, ideally a relationship should be serving something larger. You're not just serving the other person either, not to mention yourself, but, like, is it creating something that...
serving the relationship.
The relationship, or even, I think she might even put it, might be like, something, you're serving society even, through your relationship. Again, a very high ideal, I think, but maybe. Yes.
Well, take it out. How do you reach no premarital sex? And,
that's a big one for our culture.
Yes. And so I wonder how his community practices.
Yeah.
Of course, beloved by everyone.
Yeah. And also I think he's very strict about, like, for even lay people not drinking at all, which is, I think, very strict for our culture. Also I think, my teacher also says commitment. He's so big on commitment. So in relationship things, he's like, are you like, 100% committed to this person? Or sometimes he would say, are you willing to marry this person? Not like you have to marry them, but, are you willing to? Like, completely willing to, like, really, realistically, if you're going to really engage in a sexual relationship. And I think that's an interesting one for our culture, too, our modern culture, because sometimes I feel like that may be, of course, it's also less strict than Thich Nhat Hanh, but it's maybe more strict than a lot of our culture these days. And... I would like to be open to the possibility of, knowingly shorter term relationships that don't have some lifetime commitment, but that are mutually consenting and, are really careful about, like, is there potential for harm here? That's the big one, I think, with all the precepts. And it's hard to know in this case, because both people could be consenting, and then, I have no problem. And we don't need to be committed. Both say, we don't need to be committed. But we do care, but we're not total strangers. We care about each other, and we want to express our love maybe one time in this way, right? And like, but then, I think what sometimes happens is they don't realize then we thought that was fine, but then one of them is actually, oh, but actually, when you go into that territory, you change, right? Beyond what you can control. And then so, now I realize, actually, I'm actually really kind of attached to this person. And now, it's, you mean it's not, you really did mean like one night? Now I think we should be committed. And the other's like, no, no, I'm fine with this one time. And now we have this imbalance. And now someone hurt is kind of harmed unknowingly because it's powerful realm. So, I think it's up for, it's a tricky area. But I would like to think that maybe the commitment part would be have to be 100% commitment to the well-being of the other person, and you're not using them, and but you maybe don't have a lifetime commitment to be with them either. Maybe okay. Like in the Buddha's precepts, interestingly, he never mentions that. He mentions not having sex with these people who are in the commitment, but he never says if both people are not in a commitment, they shouldn't have sex without commitment. That never shows up, interestingly, in the sutras. So even, I think there's cases, I can't remember where, but maybe in commentaries about this. So even prostitution, for example, is not technically misusing sexuality in the early version of the canon, which we might think, that doesn't seem right now. But it's really looking at this very practical realm. We might see that is harming the other person, but there may be cases where it's actually not, right? Pornography is another interesting area. Like, if you're watching something like this, are people being harmed? Or not really, and yet, is it like cultivating a certain attitude that then when we have actual relations with real living people, then they tend to be more harmful because of this virtual engagement in the movies, right?
Mine seems like turning it into an object.
Yeah, it's more object.
Like for a purpose.
For yourself, generally. There's obviously no loving feeling, right, in watching. I probably... With a prostitute, I think it's generally self-serving, but maybe there'd be a way to go into that situation that would be loving.
I think if someone is a prostitute, they're deprived of right livelihood.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
I can't imagine the person who that's their fulfilled livelihood.
Yeah. Yeah. It is hard to imagine that. Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine it not being exploited.
There's a story in Being Upright in the chapter on this precept where it's some old Zen story apparently where there's a... And I think maybe prostitutes had a somewhat different role in society in ancient Japan, maybe. Somewhat, maybe. But anyway, there was this prostitute who saw a Zen monk walking by and recognized him as her old childhood friend. And said, hey, so-and-so, I haven't seen you in so long, come on up. And he was glad to see her, and he came up. And they talked for hours and reconnected and just enjoyed each other's loving friendship. And then it was late, and too late to go home for this monk back to his temple in this story. And she said, you can stay here the night, and you know, you can sleep over here. And he's like, okay. And then she, you know, you've been so kind to me, you know, I'm so used to this, and I would just like to offer you myself as a kind of just loving gift for tonight. It's no big deal for me, and it really is a loving feeling. And in the story, he said, "No, that's your realm. You can do that, and I'll just sit zazen over here in the corner." So
that's what he said
in the story. The story literally says something like, "Your job is sleeping, and my job is sitting." So like that. And I think in the Reb's commentary, he says that was a nice playful way of keeping that precept, and you know, if maybe he could have slept with her, and that would have also maybe been okay according to the precept, right? In that situation, but it's not exactly a usual prostitute situation. It's more like they're actual friends, and she happens to be a prostitute. Yeah.
Well, Each of these precepts has a positive, right? Like, not stealing, you could say the positive is, the positive practice is generosity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what's the positive? Because so far this all sounds like a bunch of prohibitory rules
to keep
the social mores intact and to keep everybody in their little, safe boxes. So what would be the positive practice?
I forgot to bring this, we have this chart of all the positive.
Yeah, I'm curious.
It's in the community room.
Just offhand, what would you say is the positive?
Well, first of all, I would say also that the negative, partly, does have this, usually the precepts are worded negatively, and for this ultimate meaning, I think the Zen people picked up on the fact that they all have a negative before them, just like the Heart Sutra. So, no sexual greed means there is no sexual greed, and we'll get into the ultimate view in a second, but, so there's some, that's another tangential virtue in the negative wording. But the positive, I think the positive sometimes is said like honoring commitments, we could say,
or supporting
loving relationships. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Don't they say sometimes when they're like qualifying it, like I won't crave or avoid a sexual relationship or something like that? I feel like maybe at the Austin Zen Center. But sometimes they put something like that.
Interesting.
Bodhidharma's
One Mind precepts has sort of the self nature is sacred and profound in the midst of dharma without attachment, not to produce the view of attachment is called not indulging in sexual greed. Yeah, that's maybe a little bit vague. But cultivating loving, wholehearted loving relationships, I think we could say. Because of course, that's a beautiful part of life, yeah. But there's room for so much pain in this area, as in all these precepts, right? So the ultimate view, the ultimate, Dogen's comment on this is, because the three wheels are pure, nothing is to be wished for. And then Kyogo, Dogen's disciple, in his comment says, the three wheels means body, speech, and mind, or greed, hate, and delusion. But in fact, I think, to me, it's a more beautiful comment to say, the three wheels are giver, receiver, and gift. We say the emptiness of the three wheels in our meal chant, and I think it's talking about this duality, right? So the three wheels, we could say body, speech, and mind are pure in not misusing sexuality, but I think more from this ultimate view, more profound to say you could say self, other, and activity in terms of sexuality. Oneself, the other person, and the activity of sex are pure, meaning like they're interdependent. And if you look carefully, you can't find one without the other. You can't have one without the other. It is dependent, co-arising, manifesting, right? And therefore, any piece of that puzzle cannot be extracted. So, and then Bonjin Dotan says, his commentary is, and maybe this was in the days when, like, he's writing for the monks that are, I think in these days, all celibate, and maybe anything about sexuality is just like, well, any sexuality is off track. So he's kind of defending this other side and saying, well, if all sexual activity was bad, then all Buddhas would not have been conceived or born.
Yeah.
not to mention, all the seven ancient Buddhas had wives and children, according to the sutras, before they left home and became Buddhas. So it's kind of like it was part of the realm of these Buddhas' lives. But I think the non-duality part is interesting here. That again, like all these precepts, if we think the other person really is separate, then we want to have them. And that's often what happens, right? So this is a nice comment, I think, about this from Tenzin Roshi. How does sexual greed arise? Self and other are seen as separate. We project reality upon the separation from a belief in the reality of this perception. The peaceful mind of the oneness of self and other is obscured. This belief wounds our consciousness, and the wound is a source of anxiety and pain. A powerful impulse arises to reunite the split mind. If this other were really other, then we could live without being in union with it, interestingly. But because it's not really other, our yearning is very strong. Sexual greed is powerful because at its root is this deep pain of separation. So I think it is an interesting thing that we are one, and we could say, maybe some people would say, that sexual union is like the closest experience to actual complete oneness that humans can have in the outside of spiritual awakening, really, which is like most people in society don't even know about that so much. Right? So of course it's a popular activity, but you could say at its root that it's a very spiritual activity because it's yearning for the oneness that we are already. I think it really, an experiencing it directly, oneness of self and other, like beyond conceptuality at its peak, right, is why the yearning, we could say, is why the desire is so strong. It's like the most intense spiritual desire for the unity, for being in union with the entire universe. But we just, you know, apply it to one person. Yes.
Pretty intense union.
Being pregnant.
To be a pregnant woman.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I haven't been there in this life. Yeah.
It's a union.
And interestingly, it is connected with sexuality too, right? So there's something about this incredible, you know, procreation of life. So interestingly, the way sentient beings have evolved, that this most powerful activity of creating life is connected with this momentary feeling of total unity. Isn't Mother Nature amazing in that way? Yeah, and then of course, pregnancy is such a whole other area, and I think. My feeling is that in these early, the early emphasis in the Buddha's Sangha for the monks of really like avoiding all sexuality maybe was about the intensity of the sense desire that the early Buddhism is talking about a lot. But also I think this very practical thing of this Sangha living out in the forest, and if you start having kids in this homeless forest Sangha, everything's going to have to change because you can't go begging for the kids, and you have to have roofs over their head. So he's like, if we're going to do this radical alternative lifestyle, we should, to keep it going harmoniously, it's going to be hard to do that with kids. And there wasn't birth control in those days. So maybe it was part of that emphasis. I think birth control does have a huge effect on what misusing sexuality even is in modern times, right? Because it's so much connected, like the commitment part. And in fact, maybe marriage is a lot about, like, if you're going to have kids, then you need this stable foundation of parents to do this. But if you're not having kids, then it's a different picture somehow. There's other reasons for it, maybe, right? Different reasons. So, yeah. Yeah. So maybe that's enough on these two precepts. So, move on to some other ones. We dedicate the merit of our practice to the complete awakening of all beings. May they realize the complete non-separation. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.